Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great guest planned for you today. Denise O'Brien will be joining me. She is the founder of the Women, Food, and Agricultural Network. She's been a community organizer and farmer for 40 years. And I'm going to tell you more about her when she comes on in a little bit. But first, I want to talk to you about some things going on in and around the city, some things that are in the news of interest, and, of course, share my weekly recipe with you. I wrote about vertical farming this week in my blog. Vertical farming, you know, is really making some strides, and vertical farming, you know, is where we can now grow food on the sides of buildings, on rooftops, in small spaces, in large cities. And it's really taking hold. And in Japan, since Fukushima, they've been doing a lot of vertical farming. And, you know, it's a question I really look forward to actually asking my guest later, what her take on it is. I mean, the thing with vertical farming is that it's mostly being done indoors right now and, you know, huge warehouses where there is not light, so it's now using artificial light, and usually they're not using soil either. They're using a watering system where they add nutrients to the water, and what those nutrients are is a question. Of course, they're proprietary, and people don't want to tell you what they are, but where are they coming from? What are those nutrients? I know with organic farming, we always talk about the soil, and it's all about the soil, and how healthy the soil is will affect how healthy your plants are. And so there's a lot of questions about vertical farming. You know, it really could be a great way to feed people in urban settings where there is not access to open space. But the question of how nutritious these fruits and vegetables are going to be, you know, still remains a question. Also, the Food and Drug Administration this week came out with guidelines for how much salt Americans should be eating. And right now, the average American eats 50% more salt than what is recommended. And as you know, in packaged foods and restaurant foods, they salt things really heavily. So the best way to really know how much salt you're taking in is to start cooking for yourself. And that's, of course, what I promote a lot of. I think, you know, we all really need to get back into the kitchen and start cooking more. You need to be aware of how much salt you're consuming, because salt is responsible for so many of the heart attacks and high blood pressure and strokes that people are having here in the States. This report actually said that 500,000 lives could be saved over a decade and $100 billion if we all reduced our salt intake. So anyway, certainly something to think about. Also, I have petitions on my website that I'd like to draw your attention to and encourage you to sign. One is about the GMO labeling. You know, the Grocery Manufacturers Association and Monsanto are really getting nervous as the Vermont law is coming into reality. And so they're panicking and they're throwing in billions or millions of dollars to fight the GMO labeling laws. But New York is really has a chance to make it a law in our state as well. So please sign the petition and let your legislators know that you would like GMO labels in New York. Also, I have a petition to let the National Organic Program know how you feel about organic chickens. Very often, you know, things are labeled organic chickens, but the reality is that these chickens have very little access. They might have a way to get out to a field, but the reality is they can't move because they're so squished in their home. So the petition is to really ask the National Organic Program to require that organic chickens have access to outdoor space and to sunlight. So please sign that petition as well. And then also there's a comeback of the DARK Act, which again is the Grocery Manufacturers Association and Monsanto in the federal government in Washington, D.C., to try to pass a law that would make it illegal for states to have their own mandatory labeling laws. And we don't want that to happen. So please sign these petitions. It's really important that we all become active and engage in our communities and fight for our right to know what's in our food and how our food's produced, know our farmers, and really support healthy eating. And that, you know, takes all of us to do that. Some really great things are going on in around the city. This weekend is the opening of the Port Washington Farmers Market, and many farmers markets are opening this coming weekend. Port Washington is the only organic farmers market in all of Long Island. It might be the only one in all of New York State that is all organic, and it is a project of the grassroots environmental group. And Slow Food North Shore, our local slow food chapter, will have a table there as always, and we will be tabling there. We'll be there this weekend for the opening day. We'll be giving out some tomato plants, organic tomato plants. So if you are in the area, stop by and say hello. Love to see you. Also this weekend, June 12th, Slow Food North Shore is celebrating the 40th anniversary of Rising Tide, which is the oldest great natural foods market on Long Island. They were here way before Whole Foods came around, and they are really committed to organic and healthy food. There's no greenwashing going on at Rising Tide. So if you're around in Glen Cove, come by and say hello June 12th. There's going to be, you know, activities for families, food giveaways, prizes, a real party. What else? Saturday, June 18th, Dr. Will Tuttle, he's the author of The World Peace Diet. He will be speaking at the Huntington Library about his best-selling book, The World Peace Diet. And following that, you're invited to have a meal across the street at the Hakuto Asian Bistro. So that's at the Huntington Library on June 18th from 2 to 6. June 26th, Slow Food North Shore is having a summer solstice celebration, and that is going to be at the IE Green Homestead right here. So if you are around, you'd like to join in a party celebrating the summer solstice, please come. You can go onto the Slow Food North Shore website and find out information about all of our activities. We're also sponsoring, along with the Long Island Food Coalition, a trip out to the Rodale Institute. The Rodale Institute is in Kutztown, Pennsylvania. It's an independent agricultural research center committed to organic practices. It's a great, great farm, and we will learn a lot going there. So if you can join us, I know it's on a Monday, but they don't do private tours on the weekends. So join us if you can. Take a personal day. It will be well worth it, July 18th. Also July 23rd, there's a farm-to-table benefit dinner that will benefit the Sylvia Center's Learning Garden, which is, is a garden that they bring New York City youth to, and it's up in Kinderhook. So if you can join for that, that should be a lot of fun. I'd like to share a recipe with all of you now. This past week, Slow Food North Shore had a film screening at the Cinema Arts Center. And, you know, I always do a Mediterranean plate, and I can make hummus with my eyes closed. But baba ganoush is one of those things that I don't make as often. But it's absolutely delicious, and it was loved by everybody. So I want to share that recipe with you. I promised people I would post it. So I used 3 eggplants, 3 relatively large eggplants that I roasted first in the oven. And you can roast them either the whole eggplant, just, put a little olive oil in and roast it on a baking sheet for an hour or so, or I usually cut them in half and roast them face down, also with some olive oil on some parchment paper, and roast that for about 40 minutes until it's really soft and mushy, and then you take it out, let it cool, and then you're going to scoop out the inside of the eggplant and put it right into a food processor or even into a bowl. It's so easy to mix up. But I put it into a full food processor along with 1 cup of tahini, 2/3 cup of lemon juice, 2 tablespoons chopped garlic, 1 tablespoon of ground cumin, 1.5 teaspoons salt, 1/4 teaspoon pepper, and 1/4 cup of chopped parsley. And I just mix that all up. If it's too thick, you can add a little water if you want it to be a little thinner. You can also adjust the seasonings to your taste, a little bit more cumin, a little bit more salt. And then I garnish it with a little olive oil and some pine nuts and some more parsley. And that's it. It's really simple. Served it with pita chips or crudité. Really delicious. So I hope you all make that. Let me know how it comes out. Let me know if you like it. That would be great. And now it's my pleasure to invite Denise O'Brien on. As I said before, she's the founder of the Women, Food, and Agricultural Network. And Denise, are you with me?
I am. Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome, and thank you so much for joining me today on the show.
You're welcome. I'm enjoying the break. I've been out harvesting lettuce this morning, so I get a chance to sit for a little bit, so I'm fine.
Oh, good.
That's good in my life.
Good. Is it as hot in Iowa today as it is here in New York?
No, actually, we have probably the last day of beautiful weather before. It's supposed to be like 96 by the weekend, and I'm just dreading that.
Uh-huh. I bet. It's much easier when you have a little bit of a breeze and it's a little cooler, right?
Oh, absolutely. That's why I'm harvesting all my lettuce. It's just it's going to be really torture on them.
Uh-huh. So how long have you been farming?
I have been farming with my husband, Larry Harris, for 40 years. I met him 40 years ago when he said he was going to be an organic farmer, and I thought, wow. And then, of course, I fell in love with him. It wasn't just about organics. But
uh-huh. And how many acres do you have?
Right now, we farm about 17 acres. When we started out farming, we started on a larger scale and about 400 acres. And we've, since that time, in that 40 years, we've downsized to a point where we have the amount of land that we can take care of in a really good stewardship way.
Mm-hmm. And you obviously can't do it all by yourself. How many helpers do you hire during the season?
The season, well, this morning I have a mother and her two high school children that showed up, and I told them that they wouldn't see me for about an hour because I would be on this interview. So They're out doing my weeding, and that's I'd like to weed. It's a meditative process for me, but I can't do everything. So the three of them are working for me this summer.
Oh, that's great.
Yes.
And what do you harvest? What do you grow?
Well, I have a community supported agriculture farm. We have about 30 members, 30 to 35 members, and I do one farmer's market. So I grow just about everything. And I have a high tunnel. So here in Iowa this year, for the first time, I grew something. I sold produce 12 months of the year. And in January and February, I was able to sell kale and spinach. And so I'm really proud of that this year. This is the first time that's happened.
Oh, that's great. So you could do it, you know, 12 months out of the year.
Yes.
You don't have the whole farm in a high tunnel, do you? Just
no, this high tunnel is just 72 feet long and 30 feet wide. So it's rather small in the size of things. But and I wouldn't mind building a couple others. And we've talked about, my husband and I have talked about that. But we also talk about downsizing as well, because we are at an age where we might just consider that we might slow down our lives. But it doesn't seem to happen.
Right, right. Now, you also raise turkeys and chickens, right?
Yes, I do. And I was listening to your chickens, your commentary. And actually, I've been looking at your website and your blog about the high-rise and about the chickens and about the salt, and I just came in from feeding my chickens, feeding and watering. I raise, once in the summer, I raise broilers for meat production, and so they are almost ready to go to the butcher, and I raise also hens for egg production. So just got done giving them their morning breakfast.
Mm-hmm. And how many chickens do you have?
Well, I've got 150 that are for meat production, and I have 30 that are egg layers.
Uh-huh. And with 30 hens, how many eggs mm-hmm. do you get a week?
Well, they do about they're not as productive as I want them to be, and I'm trying to understand that. I get about a dozen to a dozen and a half a day, and I think I should be, well, some of them are getting older, so that's a reason. So we keep the chickens. I think I have 3-year-olds, and then I just got some new ones. So we kind of keep them introducing new hens to the flock. So I'm thinking I should get more eggs per day than that, but that's what they're allowing me
to do. That's
these
what you're
days.
Doing. Uh-huh. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the organization that you started, the Women, Food, and Agricultural Network.
Yes.
What inspired you to start this organization? Where did you see the need, and when did you start it?
Well, I started it in started it in 1994, officially put it together in 1997, but the idea came out of the 1980s. I grew up in a feminist time, and in the feminist movement, the anti-war movement, and all of those in the civil rights movement, and I feel very privileged to have been growing up during that time. And when I married Larry as a farmer, right in the 1980s, we got hit with this real downturn in the economy in our rural area. It was very similar to the mortgage crisis that we had in 2008, only this was in 1980s, and the same language was used, like there were banks that were too big to fail and farms that were too big to fail. So that was a tremendous shift in our agriculture production during the 1980s. And so during that time, there was a high rate of suicide in Iowa. Women were left with raising their children in the farm. Many people lost their farms during that time. Banks were closed on Friday and opened maybe on Monday under a new name. It was a real upheaval. And so my work, I helped start an organization called Prairie Fire Rural Action. And I got funded by the Ms. Foundation from there in New York, and started a leadership development program within the Prairie Fire Rural Action. So I traveled all over the state of Iowa and the Midwest and in the United States, and understood that the women were the backbone of the farms, but they weren't included in their economic contribution to the farm, nor were they really counted as farmers or farm wives or whatever. And there was also a book what motivated me, and that was a book by Carolyn Sachs, who's a rural sociologist at the University of Pennsylvania, and she it was called The Invisible Farmer. And it was about women, yes, being invisible internationally with our aid programs from the United States and then within the United States. And so that spurred me, coming from my feminist nature, to understand that women were indeed invisible, but they were the sirens when the farm crisis emerged. They were the bookkeepers on the farm, and they said, hey, this isn't working. And at that time, the men were pretty collectively denying that there were problems, and they all had that spirit of, if I work harder, things will be okay, and that wasn't what happened. So it emerged out of the 80s, yes.
Mm-hmm. And when did it officially take hold?
1997.
Women, Food, and Agriculture. 1997?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yes. And how has it been working now? How has it changed from when you started it in 1997, almost 20 years, 19 years?
Almost 20. Yes. Well, we started out bringing women together and talking about what our needs were, and we've grown to, and there's an executive director that is different than myself. I'm loosely associated with the organization. In 2007, 2008, I gave it over to the board and to a new executive director. And my feeling was that, there were new, I had taken it to the max where I could with my abilities, and that there were other people that could come in and make it an even stronger organization. So, When we started looking at women's land ownership in the United States and in Iowa specifically, and understood that women own half the farmland. And I always had this dream that if women made decisions on the land, that the landscape would look so much different. We would have, and we've proved that with meetings throughout Iowa and now throughout the United States, that women have a different vision about what the landscape looks like, and that includes people on the land, natural resources, and conservation management, rather than this rape and pillage that has happened with industrial style of agriculture.
Right, and land conservation is, you know, paramount. I mean, we have to all look at that.
Absolutely, yes.
Conservation. And right now, you're also working with another organization, right, the Pest Action Network. Can
Pesticide
you tell us about
Action
that?
Network, yes. Yes, yes. It's a wonderful organization that has worked to it's working very strongly on bees and to understand why bees are disappearing so and why we have such a problem in the United States with that. But and they just released a new study. I don't have it in front of me, but it's about children on the front line and how pesticides are hazardous to our children's health as they grow and our health as well. And it's one of those things. It's a very strong, scientifically based study. So it would be good to go to the Pesticide Action Network website to look at that recent study. It really, our kids are in jeopardy, and it's just, we've been covering things like the GMOs, the bee situation. Atrazine is an herbicide that's used quite widely, and we also know that it's a endocrine disruptor. So they advocate very strongly for regulations on pesticides, and they worked in California specifically on methyl bromide, that is the fumigant for strawberries, and got that reduced and almost eliminated. And then in Iowa, we do a thing called drift catching, and we're trying to, so when the neighbors go out and spray around us, our 17 acres we consider it a biodiversity oasis, and we have to have buffers around us so we don't get the pesticide drift. And I just heard some tractors going into the fields, and I'm sure that they're going to be spraying today. So anyway, we monitor the air quality during their times of spraying, and turn that in, and then that's the results of that data are used in our state legislature for advocacy for making stronger chemical regulations in the state of Iowa. And it's almost impossible to do that because agribusiness, as opposed to agriculture, is king here. And it's a very male-dominated, it's very white, middle-class male-dominated, and they can do no wrong. And this is where Monsanto has its clutches. And I live here because it's where the work has to be done, and it's where my family is. But if I had my druthers, I would rather not live in a pesticide, herbicide, chemical-laden environment.
Mm-hmm. So I didn't totally understand, though. How do you prevent the drift, or you can't prevent the drift?
You can't, no. No,
right.
The only way we can in legislate is that to put regulations up like the people who are out there spraying, mostly it's custom sprayed. So people are hired to do the spraying in the fields. They have to observe the wind velocity and the wind direction. And farmers like myself we have to register ourselves on a sensitive plant, a sensitive directory, and those pesticide applicators need to go to that directory and make sure that they aren't spraying in that area on a windy day. But other than that, they have the right to do whatever they want. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have that problem on Long Island. They'll spray for mosquitoes, you know, or ticks.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, it's horrible because, again, you know, I don't have a farm. It's not my livelihood, but I do farm part of my land, and I do grow all my vegetables organically. And, you know, when I hear that that's happening, you know, I've tried to get them to not go over my property, and you can't do that. So, you know, I try to lay down, plant, you know, some tarp over my, I'm small enough that I can do that. But,
yes, and we're the ones that have to take precautions, and we're the ones that have to have the burden of proof. If we get something sprayed, then it's up to us to prove that they did it. And it's just, it's so backwards.
I know. It's up to us to prove that GMOs are unhealthy rather than them having to prove that they're healthy before they introduce them into our food supply, as if, as in Europe, you know, where they do it a little bit more in their correct order. So, I know you've also really participated, you know, a lot on the national and international stage, really, you know, bringing women into agriculture and, you know, being a voice for women. Can you share a little bit about that?
Well, yes. In 1995, I went to the United Nations International Conference on Women in Beijing, and a friend and I did a two-week workshop on the globalization of agriculture, and so we met with women from all over the world. There was a lot of pre-conference preparation for that, and then the year following that, we had a meeting of women, about 30 women from 35 countries, that's probably a reverse of the numbers, but anyway, to have a voice at the World Food Summit. The World Food Summit is a United Nations meeting that happens with the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, and we brought women together so we could make a statement on women's participation in agriculture, and so that was 1996, and then after that, pretty much did different meetings around the world, attended different conferences in that. And then in 2011, I went to Afghanistan for a year to work as an agriculture advisor. And my dream of working with women in Afghanistan was not fulfilled because the women are so hidden. And I was... I lived on a military base, and I could go out into the field, but it was always surrounded by soldiers and huge tanks and things, so it wasn't conducive. And the women were behind the walls because of, we all, I think most people understand the condition, the status of women in Afghanistan, especially in the rural areas. So, so it's just been, and I'd like to, there's programs that are farmer-to-farmer exchanges in different countries in Africa, and I've been looking at those seriously to go mostly in my downtime in the wintertime, and I'm so in the next few years I'll probably do something like that.
Mm-hmm. Do you partner at all with the slow food movement in Iowa?
Yeah, I do occasionally. I'm very rural, so I'm not near an urban area, and there are some strong slow food chapters, and a few years ago I went to Terra Madre Italy. Yes, I did. It was wonderful. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yes, to be with 5 or 6 or 10,000 farmers from around the world, and yes. So I've had a loose affiliation, you might say. Yes.
Uh huh. Yeah, I love Terra Madre. Now that I've gone, I'm kind of hooked.
Yeah.
I'm trying to go each time. I'm going to be a U.S. delegate this year again, so I'm excited.
Oh, good for you. Oh, wonderful. Yes.
So, you know, I just was mentioning that because there's, you know, the whole movement, 10,000 gardens in Africa. And so there's a big movement of, you know, starting gardens in Africa. And, you know, you can probably connect with them if you want to do some work.
Oh, that's a good suggestion. Yes, and I also do quite a bit of work with Oxfam America, I've hosted African women. They have this program called Farm Heroes, and I've had several of the women who have been designated as farm heroes in their particular countries, mostly Tanzania and Kenya, here at the farm, and it's been wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think, you know, the cross-cultural experience can be so positive, especially if, you know, if what we're able to help them with is what is native to them. You know, it's
exactly.
Not really great if we go in and try to start planting corn there, but instead, you know, try to look at, you know, what they're growing already and try to help them with that.
Exactly, and that's the way I felt when I flew, when I got to Afghanistan and I went through my training and I flew in a helicopter to the base where I was going to be stationed. I looked down from the helicopter and it was like, whoa, this place is really green. They don't need me, you know. And there was during that year when I was mostly working with male farmers, it was they had their systems and I exactly like you say felt like we needed to work with them. And my male colleagues that were from the USDA or from wherever, they just wanted them to get straight rows. They wanted them to do different things like we do here. They just really ruined our country. And I would see them, they would crop companion plants. They have all this indigenous knowledge that they just, their problem was that it was a war-torn country and their fields were mined. And because prior to the Soviet invasion in Afghanistan, they exported pistachios and grapes, and they have been, even though their country is the size of Texas and 12% of their land is arable, they were an exporter of the products that they grew.
Mm-hmm. How do pistachios even grow?
Pardon?
How do pistachios grow? Just out of curiosity, I've never seen.
On trees, on bushes. They're more like bushes, yeah.
Bushes, uh-huh.
Yes.
Wow, fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
I would think it would be a little scary to be in Afghanistan, you know, working in fields that have been mined.
Well, it was, but I have an adventurous spirit, so, and I wanted to do, I've always done a lot of traveling since I was in high school, and so, and my husband is actually someone who doesn't care so much, in fact, I asked him just the other day, I said, so, if I go to Africa, would you go with me? And he said, no, it's okay for me to go. So,
not so interested, huh?
No. He's a real homebody, our daughter was in Honduras for a year, and we went to visit her there, and it was. He's a very gentle soul, and he doesn't even like to go to cities. I once took him to Washington D.C., and when he sees the poverty and everything, it just torments him. So he'd rather not see it.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, what do you think about the future of small scale farming versus mm-hmm. the industrial mm-hmm. agricultural push that we have here?
Right. Well, it's going to be that. From the United Nations report to different things that you see around, it's that the world is going to feed itself by small-scale farming. But the you know, the agribusiness corporations that own Washington won't see it that way because they want the world to be, you know, catering to their needs of profit, and so they'll do everything, and they have the money to spend on all the, you know, marketing and all the propaganda they put out to say they can feed the world, when all of the research that's being done is showing that that's not right, and that GMOs are causing incredible problems with resistance, and you know, some people are linking it to health issues, and some scientists are in that. So it's going to be this tension between agribusiness and small-scale farming. And it's really, the thing about small-scale farming is it's very labor-intensive. That's the biggest cost in my operation. And it's, but technology is being developed, mechanization and other, techniques for weeds and disease that you mentioned the Rodale Press earlier. I've been to the Rodale Farm, the Institute, and that's been the place where we've always sought information for the last, 40 years we've been farming. But our state universities that are supposed to be, doing research for farmers are held in the hands of corporations, and the research has gone away from us and been captured for large scale farming. So there's this battle that goes on, and it's the same as you talked about the organic standards and that on the national level there's always that issue about expanding them or just allowing a little bit more in or something, and we have to be right. very diligent to be able to keep that away. We had our organic inspection on our farm on Saturday this week, and it was a 3-hour inspection, and it's very thorough, and we need to be very restrictive about what happens because in order to preserve the organic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really crazy. I mean, when you hear about the studies that GMOs are safe or this or that, when you really, follow the money, you see that all the funding for all the universities in this country that are doing all the testing. I mean, the National Organic Standards Board and the Food and Drug Administration and the Environmental Protection Agency, they use the research studies that universities have been doing because they don't have money to do their own studies. And all those studies are tainted because they're funded by Monsanto's and other big corporations that are like that. And it's just,
it's very
conflict of interest.
Because it's like, I live in the belly of the beast. I live surrounded by all of the agribusiness, all of the industrial agriculture that is just causing havoc. And someday, probably when I'm long gone, there'll be a realization that we've done wrong by Mother Earth.
Hope that realization doesn't take that long. It's terrible. You heard me talking at the beginning of the show about vertical farming. What is your take on that? I listen to Will Allen and, others, and we organic farmers always talk about the soil, and it's all about the soil.
Yes.
What do you think about this vertical farming and whatever nutrients they're putting in the water? Are those just chemicals?
Yeah.
Are they?
Well, I have my reservations, but I also understand that urban areas need to have, if we're going to have local production, we're going to have to do it in a variety of different ways. Now, and actually, I do a form of vertical farming because my tomatoes and my cucumbers are now growing up in my high tunnel. We have twine that goes from the ground to the 20 feet up, and I end up using a ladder at the end of the season to pick my tomatoes and things, but they are in the soil for sure, and so I have my reservations, but I'm being open-minded about it because we need to feed people, and people need to feed themselves the best way we can, and with the healthy and nutritious food, and So I think that like I say, I'm open-minded about it. And the Japanese, and you were talking about Fukushima, they are very, especially with what's happened to them in the nuclear, industry and that, they are very sensitive to foods. And I trust them, that they're doing the best thing they can do. And because all the nutrients in that don't have to be chemically based. So there are ways that we can do this. So even though I have my reservations, I have an open mind about it, yes.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Yeah.
And what's regenerative agriculture? I know you've talked about that and how that can help climate change. Can you talk a little bit about what is meant by regenerative agriculture?
Sure. It's, what we're doing, what my husband and I feel very diligent about is that it is our responsibility to leave what we've been given and had the privilege to take care of in better shape than when we arrived and on mm-hmm. this land. And so in order to do that, we have to work with the soil. We have to work with, you know, the resources that we have to make it a better place. So we use composting. I have a worm farm, and I use compost tea. I heard you talking about Michael Phillips. I'm going to have to go and listen to his. I love that man.
Uh-huh.
And my son-in-law is here right now, putting together his concoction of EM, the effective microbes to go and spray on the apple trees. So, we went to a lecture by him, a whole day workshop by him several years ago. So, it's our responsibility. Regenerative agriculture is about leaving things in better shape. And so we need to build the microbes, the biota in the soil and that so it can work. We can work together to make really healthy soil, to make really healthy vegetables and
mm-hmm.
fruits. Yes.
Right. Yes, I was so pleased to have discovered Michael because I also am raising or growing apple trees and, you know, wanting to do it organically. And for me, you know, it's not worth doing it if I can't do it organically.
Exactly. Yes.
And, you know, where we do live, we do have cedar apple rust, which he doesn't have. Oh. Do you have that by you?
No, he's way up on the Canadian border in Maine, I think.
Right.
Or New Hampshire?
Right.
New Hampshire. Oh, do we have, yes. And we have cedar apple rust here, yes. We have cedar trees that fill the ditches and that, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, so I deal with that stuff. And, you know, I need to read more of his books and learn more about how to build up the soil and do that regenerative work so that my trees can fight it off on their own.
Absolutely, to build their systems, to build their, you know, and that's what, when I've talked to different people about nutritious, you know, healthy nutritious eating and that, I really equate the our gut to the soil, and that we create probiotics for the soil we eat, or we, you know, or we take capsules or we eat the food that will give us probiotics for our guts, and I think they're very similar in that way. And Michael's magical. There are people like him in the world that we need to listen to more.
Mm-hmm. And what's so amazing is how interconnected the movement is of farmers who are really trying to do the right thing. I mean, it seems, you know, that everybody knows each other. You know, you're in Iowa, but he's in New Hampshire, and you still have worked together,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's a smaller circle than we think.
Yes, yes, yes. And yet, the net is cast wide, and the influence that we're having, I have a good perspective, having been an organic farmer for 40 years now, and when we started farming, people looked at us askance, and we couldn't say the O word out loud, you know, and now we can be open about it. And my local grocery store in a town of 7,000 people came to me at the farmer's market the other night, and they said, we'll take everything you want to bring into us. And I looked at them, and I said, at my price, and they said, yes. So that's a big change, but it's taken a long time to get there.
Mm-hmm. Right. I kind of feel the same way in the natural foods movement, you know. I mean, I stopped eating meat over 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I did it, it's like, forget it. You told someone you were a vegetarian, they, you know, had no idea what to do for you or how to feed you.
Right.
Or
they give you cheese or they give you, yes, right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I learned to cook in bulk, you know, I ended up having a catering company, but I learned at college because I went to college and the vegetarian meal plan was so pathetic back then you know, instead of going to art class, I started cooking for the vegetarian meal plan at college, and that's kind of got me started. It is, you know, you just realize how things move slow, but they do move, you know, we are moving in that direction. So can you share with us what you see as the future for women in agriculture? Because I've read some of the statistics, and it seems like the majority of the new organic farmers are actually, there's more women than men, I believe.
Yes, the women are going in a quicker pace, and they're having smaller farms and smaller livestock. So many women are doing goats and dairy goats or goat meat, and sheep and sheep dairies. And so there really are. The struggle, I think the struggle for anyone, especially women farmers, is the barrier of our whole thinking in our country about cheap food. So people don't want to pay the price that it costs to grow the food. Now, my neighbors can go out there and spray chemicals, and they can, you know, get the soil, and it's a dead. Their soil isn't even living, you know, and they can do that with no repercussions, and you know, and they are feeding a system of, and they're not even growing food actually. If you think about it, they're growing commodities, and they're feeding them into ethanol and meat production basically. But the struggle is that they're doing it as cheaply as possible, and so we in the United States brag about how much in consumers pay of the food dollar. And it's like 10 to 20 cents. I don't know what the latest figures are, but and it's just disgusting, because the people who are putting, you know, their life and their on the line to grow good food, and that can't struggle to make a living. And mm-hmm. So people, they want to farm so badly. And I mentor young women, and, well, and not just young women, because there are women of all ages that have gone into farming. And I'm currently mentoring several, and they are young women, and they want to farm, and they have to work a secondary job in order to do the thing that they're passionate about, and they do the best and they love. And everybody works to be independent of, to be, to raise, to have their income specifically from the farm, and it's almost impossible for anyone to do that. So on the other side of that, consumers need to understand that the price they're paying for, they're not getting gouged when you have to pay more for organic because of all of the time it takes me to, you know, pull the weeds, to inspect for insects. Every morning I go out and I do integrated pest management, and I look and see what I've got, you know, out there, and I either, you know, hand kill the pests that take disease from plant to plant, or, you know, put up barriers and things like that. So it takes a full, more than a full day to farm, and yet we don't get the returns we need to be able to make a living at it. People can't afford health care. They can afford health care now because of the American, you know, Health Care Act, but it's very difficult. And mm-hmm. so that's I would like to see that change in the future, that farmers, the place that I am a CSA farmer for in Omaha, which is close to me, I am that particular, that personal farmer, and I like that type of situation. We have really strong relationships, and people are so glad. We took off 1 week between Memorial Day. So last week I was there, and people are saying, "Oh, we're so glad you're here. We eat so badly when you're not, you know." And uh-huh. So I think a farmer should be at the status of a doctor, and that we are providing good, healthy food for a good, healthy life, you know. And it takes a lot, scientific knowledge. It takes hard work, manual work, and it takes a lot to get that food to those people, to the consumers' tables.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I love that I think they should have the same status as doctors, because you eat food that's grown by an organic farmer, and you probably don't need your doctor so much, you know?
Exactly.
Right.
Which might cause problems in the medical industry.
Run out of time, I want to just talk to you a little bit about the farm-to-school movement. I know you've been involved with that, too. Can you share how that's going in Iowa, and how have you been working on that on the national level as well?
Yeah, I did. I'm not so much involved as I was. I have a good friend, Chef Ann Cooper.
Ann Cooper?
Yes. He and I were Kellogg Fellows together, and I know I just, the national meeting was just in Madison, and I miss going to those things, but being a full-time farmer and having things scheduled in May and June don't quite work for me, but it's slowly gaining hold, and again, I've worked on it from the very beginning, and we're getting some programs in our schools here, and mostly it starts around, you know, the schoolyard garden, and Alice Waters started that years ago, and other people besides Alice, but she's the most famous one, name around it. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. once, and I think actually for the future of agriculture, kind of tying into what you asked me before, I think those will be our future farmers. They won't necessarily come from a farm, but they've been captured by the bug of growing things, and they'll become our next farmers. And they'll become aware of how diligent it is to be able to be a farmer, you know, and they'll be passionate about it. They'll be captured by the soil. And so I'm optimistic about it. I wish it would grow a little bit quicker, but things take time.
Right. So you do have some in your local schools or not yet?
Yes. Yes. There's a community we have in Iowa. I was on the first advisory board for a farmed cafeteria, and we did some programs in our school. It kind of fell off because the state didn't fund the program, and that's what it always takes, is it takes champions to be able to want to fund those kind of things. So, but there's a program in out of Omaha that's going out into the rural areas, and it's run by the United Methodist Ministries, and it's called the Big Garden, and they are doing education and schoolyard gardens and then helping take care of the gardens through the summer, which everybody says, oh, we can't do that because the summer, you know, interrupts that. And that's a weak excuse. I think it's a very feeble way to look at things. But there are some programs emerging. And of course, I'm in the heartland of the United States, and the rural areas, it's harder. It just takes so much longer for those things to take hold. I see my friends on both coasts that, you know, things just move forward with such, you know, and not so much quickness sometimes. I shouldn't be so general to say that, but it takes a bit longer here, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm on the East Coast, and it still takes long here. I mean, it's just, you know, I participated in the chef movement to schools, you know, with Michelle Obama.
Yes.
And,
yes.
You know, I went into a school, but they had no money, and they wanted me to, you know, I could make a suggestion one time go in, but if they wanted me to come in and really work with the staff and change the cafeteria, you know, that's a full-time job. You know, you can't volunteer to do that.
No.
You know, and there was no funding for it. So it's, it was, you know, exciting in theory, but I found that I couldn't really do anything with it without, you know, getting paid.
So, right, it's a very time sucker. Yeah.
So what are you mostly in the community working on right now? Is it the Fast Action Network, or is it, you know, working with women? What besides the farming are you mostly involved in?
Yeah, I sort of have my fingers in a lot of things, and one of the things that I love the most is I have 6 grandchildren, and so they're out at the farm a lot. So on a personal level, that's where I can be a strong influence. And our children are really, it's really interesting that their perspective, having been raised on organic food and with the organic philosophy and that, to see their friends now kind of grasping that, although when they were in school, that it was like they were kind of an oddity. They would take blue corn chips to school and things, you know, whole wheat bread and things like that. They would take their lunches instead. But I'm involved in my community with the local farmers market, and I'm on, and there's another organization actually that I'm heavily involved with, and that's called SILT, and it's Sustainable Iowa Land Trust. So it's a land trust to work, and one of the hard things for young people who have not been from a farm, who don't come from land, it's hard for them to find land to be able to start a farm on. So I'm working with this organization in Iowa as a land trust, working with women, mostly with women, but not all, who want to put their land in a land trust to be able to pass it on to a farm, a beginning farmer to grow food for their local community. So it's an idea that is around the country in different places, but it's a newly introduced here, and it's for people, again, the emphasis of it is for food security. So we're working on that, that piece that the land will be put in trust in order to grow food. It's not about a natural, an extinct flower or insect or whatever. It's about preserving land for food production, which sounds a little bit out of line with, because in Iowa, that's what people think that we grow food here, and it's a misconception by most of the people who live in the state.
Well, no, it's so funny. When people think of agriculture, they do think of growing food, and the reality is that the food is labeled, if you're growing food, you're growing specialty crops. You know, they consider food specialty crops, and, you know, corn for ethanol is, you know, standard. It's a little bizarre.
It is. It's totally, like I said earlier, it's totally upside down, yes.
Right, right. It really is. Well, it has been a pleasure, Denise, talking with you. The work you're doing is great. And I'm there with you as far as passing it on to your grandchildren. I'm waiting for mine. I don't have any yet, but I did a workshop actually this past weekend with my daughter. And just when you pass on your values to your kids and you see the fruition of that, it's just the best, right?
It's just absolutely wonderful. It is. And yeah, all of our grandchildren, we have a 9-year-old granddaughter, and then everybody else is, we have 5 under 6 years old. So they were all, and there were no twins. They were just kind of born bam, 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 bam. So, we spend as much time together as we can. And that's our future. And so we really have to nurture them. And I try not to worry about what their future is about, because just that I can make them very, I can help create very strong characters in them to be able to handle what will be ahead for them.
Right. Right. And that's what we have to do as mothers, as women. We just have to support what is here to be as strong and as conscious as possible so that they can handle what is to come. So thank you for doing your work, Denise.
You're welcome. And thank you for inviting me on. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, you're welcome. And enjoy the rest of the day out in that heat. And everyone who's been listening, thank you so much for joining us. I hope to see some of you at the Farmers Market this weekend or at the celebration of Rising Tide. Have a great rest of the week, and I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now. I'm not afraid.